Hello, Jim.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening. So here we are live on BBS Radio, and we have Jim McCarthy joining in. He will be interviewed by Joel and myself when it's flying up in the sky to go back to the lands where his sister last lived. I welcome you all on BBS Radio. I welcome you all here on the conference phone line. And I believe Joel has also joined us. Hello, Joel.
Hey, how are you doing, Hi?
Just fantastic. Hey, let me first get the recorder going, actually. 1 second.
This conference is being recorded.
All right. So, hello again. This is December the 11th, Wednesday, and we are here with Jim McCarthy and Joel Terry from Chicago. And myself, I'm Gijs, and we will have an interview tonight. I put the line on mute, and I will turn off the ding. So. All right, so here we are, the mutes, we're muted. So it is the three of us now, Joel. First of all, Jim, how are you tonight?
Doing well. We're a little chilly here in Kentucky, so it's good to be indoors, and it's a nice thing to be doing to talk to other folks.
All right. I'm so glad you're here with us.
Glad to be
here. The same thing we've got, in Chicago. It dropped and dropped and dropped. The wind chill factor, they said the gusts were going down to minus 24.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. All right.
That's cool.
And colder and colder. Jim, it is really a thrill. To have an opportunity to go through a series of questions, have an opportunity to speak with you. You're one of those people that I said, you know, when I was going through the raw material or the log one reading it, I was always curious as to who the guy was, you know, sitting off in the back. And because, you know, kind of the drama of what was going through that, a lot of it focused on what was going on with Carla and her condition as well. And,
right.
You know, and I always wondered about the dynamic in the beginning where no one was sharing anything with Carla and what that must be like. I was like, oh, here's this guy that's sitting back there. And you know, you got to be the proverbial, fly on the wall.
Right.
You got to see all of this come down. And I was like, you know, to be a fascinating character. So for a lot of people, I think on a Wednesday call, if anyone's calling in, they know who Jim is. There was Don Elkins, there was Jim McCartney, and there was Carla Ruckert. And through that group, that is where the Log One was channeled through. And it was stated that not until this dynamic had come together that they had created an energetic connection that made this level of or this exchange a possibility. And what I wanted to do, Jim, if you'll indulge us here, is maybe go back to the very beginning for yourself. And what I was looking for, and I was wondering, is what is that point in your life? What were your experiences in the beginning as a child, or what was it that kicked into you that said, this is where you wanted to direct your life? There was something, was it something esoteric? Was there some large event as a child or as an adult that really turned you in the direction to it and kind of got us?
Well, I guess I was a late bloomer. I was 21 years old in college before I ever became interested in metaphysical questions. I just sort of sailed through my life prior to that, having a good time in high school. I got good grades fairly easily, went out for all the sports and enjoyed sports. I think Carla says it's because I didn't have dance in my little hometown of Lexington, Nebraska, 5,000 people. So I was a late bloomer. And after I got out of college, I decided to try to discover something about this school I found in Colorado, Adventure Trail Survival School. They were teaching what was called brain self-control and contact with advanced intelligences. And the idea was here that if you worked on those handful of problems in your own life that were blocking the natural flow of brain energy up into the frontal lobes and higher consciousness, that then if you did that, that you could begin contacting other intelligences. It was just a natural part of the universe that teachers would appear when the student was ready, the old thing. So I went to that school, and I learned what they had to teach me. I came back, worked there 1 year as a teacher, and then I got my own piece of property in central Kentucky and had that type of a school program going for a couple of years. And then I heard about Don Elkins and Carla Ruckert from a group of folks on the other side of the county. This was the early 70s where the Back to the Land movement was really popular, and well-educated young people from the cities usually were moving to the countryside. And we had food buying clubs to get our food, and on the other side of the county there was one that also had a meditation group, and they were talking about a couple of folks from Louisville, Kentucky, Don Elkins and Carla Ruckert, that were having meditations in which you were able to contact intelligences that were supposedly extraterrestrial. So that sounded really interesting. Came up, met Don and Carla. For about a year, a friend and I drove every Sunday night. It was a round trip, about 150 miles, to visit with them and to hear what they had to say. And we got along so well that they invited me to join them in their work and be a third party. Carla had been disabled for a while, not able to use a typewriter. They needed somebody to do office work and so forth. But I was all interested in going out to Oregon and joining up with Cosmic Awareness Communications. I've been on the mailing list for a number of years. They had a channel, Paul Shockley, who was supposedly channeling the same entity Edgar Cayce channeled, the Akashic Records of the planet. So I went out there and had a wonderful 2 months, but all of a sudden I had a chance to earn a whole lot of money, and I didn't have anything against money, but that wasn't why I went there. So I took a weekend off in my little trailer to retreat, to meditate, to think about what I should do. So 30 seconds into the meditation, I got the very clear impression I needed to return to Louisville, Kentucky, and I joined Don and Carla. I'd just driven 2,500 miles to get out to Oregon, and so now here I was going back to Kentucky. It took me a 5,000-mile trip over 2 months in general here to travel the actual 70 miles that separated where I lived in central Kentucky.
You go next door.
Right. So that was how it started. I came back to join Don and Carla. Within 3 weeks of my return, the raw contact started as Carla was teaching an advanced student how to do the basic channeling, and Don happened to be the third person. We always needed three people. And I just happened to be out shopping at Kroger's for groceries during the first contact. So that's how it all started for me.
So in the first contact, could you explain that a little bit further? I mean, you were in the grocery store?
Right. Carla had a practice of helping students who wanted to learn to channel, doing that whenever there was an opportunity to, you know, the schedules matched and all that. So a fellow decided that he wanted to learn to channel. Leonard was his name. And so they got together in the usual channeling location, which was with Don and Carla in the living room. And Don happened to be there that day. He was a pilot for Eastern Airlines at the time, so he was gone half the time. But that particular day, he was there. So that freed me up to go shopping at Kroger's to do the shopping for the three of us. And I didn't think anything of the fact that, you know, Carla was teaching another fellow to learn to channel, because that was a commonplace thing. She taught me to channel 25 years ago, I guess. So I was out shopping, and when I came back, I had a sack of groceries in both arms. So I opened the door rather clumsily, and you'll notice that during the first contact, it says, there's a questionnaire. Can you say anything about the coming planetary changes? Ross says, I preferred to wait until this instrument had again reached the proper state of depth of singleness or one-pointedness before we spoke. And the reason they had to wait and get her deeper, because I just walked in the front door and interrupted the raw contact, not knowing that it was the raw contact. And so I just went on through into the kitchen and emptied the groceries out, and they continued on. And later on, after the contact was over, Don said, I think we have something here that you need to transcribe as soon as possible. And now that was very unusual for Don. He was very laid back. He didn't really need anything done in a hurry. So that gave me an idea that there was something special there. And after I got the session transcribed, the two of us, Don and I, realized we had something worthwhile. Carla didn't get to read any of the sessions until 21 of them had gone by, because Don, being a scientist, he didn't want to give her any indication of what was going on so that it wouldn't influence the outcome of the channeling.
That was one of the questions that I had inside my notes, and I thought it was 27 sessions. And that was another thing, you know, that I thought of is, when was it, or who was it, or was it, you know, collective, that, you know, that both of you decided, or Don decided, and he was pretty particular about data, not to share that information, and what that must be like was something that was coming out so profound and Carla being unaware of that, what was that like, that, you know, your closed door sessions?
Right. Well, in Carla's opinion, it was a cruel joke. But Don made the decision because he had been investigating UFO contact in these channeled meditations since the early 60s. By that time, this was 1981, it was almost 20 years afterwards, he had a real desire to make this something that could be shown to the scientific community. He was hoping that by using scientific methods of not allowing her to be familiar with anything that was going on, that it wouldn't lose contact, and therefore it would lend credence to the possibility that it might actually be authentic. Well, after a while, Carla got tired of Don and I saying things like, well, is your mind-body-spirit complex distorted towards fullness-emptiness? Now, we were kind of toying with her a little bit, just playing, playfully. But yeah, after a while, it just got kind of old for Carla, and she just said, Don, you've got to ask, you know, just ask them if it's okay. And so he did. And Ross said that there was no problem letting her read it because her vocabulary was, you know, though it was large, they didn't have to refer just to it. They could, she was a good channel. She was open, and it wouldn't affect the contact by letting her read it. So she finally got to read it, and she was very happy about that because, you know, I mean, you can imagine knowing that this unusual behavior is going on. People are keeping something from you, but they're doing it good-naturedly, but it's unusual. It's never really happened before. So that was the reason we asked and got the information to let her read it.
What was the first information that kind of kept you and Don up at night? Because I mean, it probably was early on. I would think subsequently there were several, but what was the first LMG moment? That, you know, was it after the first contact was translated that you looked at each other and said, "Is it going to keep us up tonight?"
Right, that was it. Because Ross spoke a language that really made sense to us, and it seems to make sense to a certain sort of person or a small percentage of people. For a lot of people, it's too thick. It's too like German philosophy or something. But for certain people, it just has a way of being both precise and profound that is like an equation. It just makes sense. So for us, right away, as I was transcribing, I realized that this was totally different of the way that answers were phrased and the precise choice of words and how it just seemed to have a certain poetry about it. So for us, it was right away. And we were really thrilled to be able to partake in it. We knew right away that it was something special.
Other than a transcriber, you know, an energetic anchor for Carla during those as well, in order not to have any out-of-body experiences, and what else would you say? Were you an organizer? What was the thing, the dynamic that you brought that Don and Carla were looking for?
Well, I had a physical energy that neither of them really had. At a later point, far down in the list of sessions, each of us had a certain quality we had about it. Carla was exemplified love, and Don wisdom, and I power, physical energy. So that was what they really needed. Don had the wisdom and the experience over the years of his investigating this phenomenon in general, the channeling phenomenon, but other paranormal abilities as well, psychic healing and so forth. They've done a lot of work there. He had that ability and that experience and that intellectual quality and that intuitive quality. He could follow up questions so well. But he really didn't do work well. I mean, he was good at running. He could run long distance, but he'd rather fly the couch. Being a pilot, he figured that, you know, he'd done his thing during the week and earned the money, so now he needed to think. He said we all needed to spend more time thinking, and he did it. He actually thought a lot. And frequently, he'd be over on the couch drawing invisible lines in the air. We never knew exactly what those were. But Carla's quality was love, all compassionate, unconditional love. And physically, she had had rheumatoid arthritis for many years before that, had difficulty doing a lot of work, and had been disabled since age 25, and she was now 37. So that, you know, was something that she apparently had chosen before the incarnation to limit her physical activity so that she would focus inward and do the inward work. But I was, you know, quite physically active, like I said, in high school. I went out for all the sports, and I liked to just do things with my body, do physical labor. When I was on the land, starting my own school in central Kentucky, I didn't have electricity or any kind of power. I had heat by fire and light with kerosene lamps, and I did all the work. I built the cabin, and built a road up to it and built a couple other cabins. It's just something that I like to do, even though I'm rather small, and like 5'7", 140. I just have a lot of energy, and I like to do things physically, and that's what I basically have done over the years. Is there's always been some of the work to do in the yard or so forth. Like I've just recently retired from 11 years of running my own lawn service. So that was what I had to offer, was physical labor and the energizing of Carla to the contact.
Did you suffer any ill effects from doing the work? Because Carla would waste, you know, 1-2.5 pounds during that. Did you suffer any, and then other ill effects that came out over time?
No, not really, not right away. There was, Rob said, over a long period of time, the 106 sessions that Carla did, there was a wearing effect, a physical wearing, a weariness that she would take on, say, like 85% of it, because the contrast between the third density we inhabit normally, and she was in normally, and where she stayed with those of Ra while the Ra contact was going on, even though she was not aware of where she was, apparently where she was enough different that there was a wear on the body coming back and forth. And Don and I would experience about 15% of that. And I've got to say, over the years, I've noticed some of that. Although Ra said if we experimented with the physical energy and just were physically active, we would discover that we still had the same physical energy that we always had. It just didn't feel like we had it. We felt tired, felt weary.
Was that difficult to watch? I mean, from Carla's standpoint, did you guys ever feel that you may have to shut down? I knew there were periods of resting and the contact was withdrawn, but was that difficult for Don and yourself? I mean, sidebar conversation saying, you know, are we doing the right? What was that?
Well, it was one of those things that, as Ross said, we had to wend our way through the experience on our own because there was only so much information they could give us without infringing on our free will. So we had to discover over a period of time that having a session every day and sometimes two sessions a day was much too wearing on her. So we backed off, but we did that more because we discovered ourselves. Ra could occasionally give us clues as to what to do, but only clues. I mean, for example, there was always some sort of indication of the proper alignment at the end of a session. Don would ask, is there anything we can do to make the instrument more comfortable or to improve the nature of the contact? That was just a standard question. And at that time, Ra had an opportunity, if they felt it was necessary, to give us some sort of a clue. And they always gave us some sort of an indication as to the proper alignment of questions. Once they gave so minute a discrepancy of proper alignment that we had to think, there's something else going on. That, you know, that minor discrepancy means there's something else going on. So the discussion that Don and I had as a result of that clue by Ra led us to make more time between the sessions and to realize that we were not being wise in the use of the instrument. We were being overly stimulated to compassion, you know, to being of service to others, because we realized this could well be very helpful information. So after that clue, we decided to cut back on the periodicity of the session.
Go ahead,
I want to ask you, Jim, for how long have you known Don Elkins before he passed?
Prior to the Ra contact, I only knew Don for about a year. It was during that time that I was coming up from where I live, that homestead situation in central Kentucky, and meeting him and seeing him on weekends, and then eventually helping them move from that location to the one where we finally had the Ra contact. I started doing more things with him over that year, but I'd only known him a year prior. However, I got to say that when I first walked in and met him for the first time and looked up into his eyes, and like I say, I'm 5'7", and he was 6'5". I looked up, I saw these blue-gray eyes that just seemed to have something familiar in them. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, from that time on, it just seemed like things naturally flowed for us. We didn't have to wonder, you know, whether there was a harmony between us. It was obvious to all of us.
That was the question I had circled is, what was it like to move into that dynamic? You know, was it easy or was it difficult? Because, I mean, Don had already established some sort of legacy in the sense that he had put serious work into this contact, and Carla had already done that. Was it effortless, it sounds like?
It was effortless because it happened slowly over a period of time was one of the reasons I believe it was effortless. And also because there was this natural harmony between us. I mean, Don and Carla had been together for 12 years prior to that. And during all that time, he'd been working as a pilot for Eastern Airlines. She originally met him back when he had a professorship at the University of Louisville as a professor of physics and mechanical engineering. that's when he began the original experiment of inviting 12 of his mechanical engineering students, which at that time were all male. Scientific school was all male then, in 61. So 12 of the students plus the girlfriend of one of them, which happened to be Carla. And Jim DeWitt, which was the fellow who was her boyfriend and was in this group, asked Don if it was okay to bring his girlfriend because she liked to meditate. And Don said, sure, that's fine. Because he'd met her previously before, and he'd known about this feeling, this harmony between them. Even though Jim DeWitt, her boyfriend, and she were married for 4 years, Don realized they were going to be together eventually. And afterward, just humorously, Carla said, why did you tell me right away? You would have saved me 4 years of misery. And Don said, well, I knew it was a good catalyst. Well, anyway, he had that type of sense of humor and a long range of view of things. So they've been together for 12 years. He'd been investigating paranormal field for 25 years, and she helped him in 1968 write the book Secrets of the UFO, which was his summary at that time of his 25 years of experience. So I joined them, they having had this momentum behind them. But like I say, we just kept doing more and more together, and it seemed very natural. And the house that I helped them move into, each of us had our own room. In fact, I had a room back in another wing of the house. There was the office back there, and then there was my room. And there was another little kind of portico that separated the main house where Carla had her room and Don had his room. So each of us was rather solitary in nature and appreciated solitude, but Carla and Don had this special harmony between them that they'd had for so long that they were always watching TV together in the evenings, watching MASH was their favorite program. And I was back reading things that I've been interested in for years, and then we'd get together for meals and maybe go out for a movie, or maybe we'd get together and go out to eat. So we had things we did together, but we also spent a lot of time alone and kept our own space.
When it comes to the, it sounds like they came pretty easy, but I was wondering among, because, you know, you're dealing with the scientists, is that was everybody, just because of the dynamic of the group stepping into it, was honesty really a given, or were the rules in the house something that was kind of spelled out as to how everybody functioned?
I guess the way we functioned was the blending of our personalities. Carla has this brilliantly shining blue ray of communication. Honesty is very easy for her. She can't help herself. She speaks what's on her mind, and you don't get away with stuff with Carla. And, you know, occasionally she's wrong, but not usually. So she sort of kept us honest. Don was willing to be honest, but he was taciturn. He was a melancholy man, is what Carla called him. He'd known from age 26 that this was an insane asylum and that the best she could hope for was a private room. That was his attitude about the planet Earth. So he had this ability to communicate, but he needed to draw him out a bit. And I was sort of willing to learn to communicate. I hadn't been real good at it throughout the years, but with Carla and the relationship that we developed, she was instrumental in helping me open up and become, you know, able to share my feelings and thoughts and, you know, be a regular human being instead of a recluse, which I had been for 6.5 years on the land by myself before I met Don and Carla. And the school I had going was only 2 months out of the year and then the weekend. So I had a pretty solitary life and enjoyed it a great deal. And prior to the raw contact, I would say that was the high point of my life.
The you mentioned there, you know, drawing out Don. Did Don, there was 12 years prior to stepping in there. Did Don ever share with you, 20 years of research prior to? Things that he had discovered, or did he start to put together an understanding, or did he ever speak about UFOs that he saw? And there was so much research into that. Did he share?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had some wonderful conversations after meals in the living room. Maybe, you know, we'd just turn the TV off and talk about somebody. Maybe we'd been visited that day by an old friend who was part of his past and his investigations. You know, it'd be various things that would spark us, and we'd sit and talk and have these basically round the campfire type of thing, you know, where you talk about things that you hardly ever talked about before. But he was very easy to draw out about that because it was his life's work. He wanted to know about UFOs. He was 17 years old when he first got interested in UFOs. That happened early for him. He was a student of Mantell Flying School here in Louisville. He learned to fly early. And Tom Mantell was also a captain in the Kentucky Air National Guard, and he was the one in 1948 that died chasing a UFO. So Don's flight instructor died chasing a UFO. here in Kentucky. It made national news as one of the first cases that really got people interested in thinking that UFOs might be real, because here was a military individual died flying after a UFO trying to, you know, chase it. So his interest began early, and he had a lot of experiences to share. He and Carl had shared a lot. I mean, they'd been to the Philippines and to Mexico looking for psychic healers. They found some good ones. They found some hoaxes, too, but they found some good ones. And Carl has worked on, and Don has worked on. So they had all this to share. And I know I was just like a sponge drawing up all this information, because, like, I'd been on my own just reading and doing things and hadn't really had the experiences that they had had. So, yeah, we had a lot of late-night conversations that were really fascinating. We especially had them when people were visiting from out of town and were, you know, bringing the newness of their investigation, or the excited at being able to talk to somebody about this, because so many people who read our material are isolated and don't have anybody to talk to. And so when we have our homecoming gathering in the fall, they really are excited to come, because nobody's going to think they're crazy. You know, and they can talk about whatever they want to whomever they want, as long as they want. So, yeah, we had a lot of great conversations.
Can you share with us maybe what was the, can you recall what a major a point for you, what that catalyst that said, you know, I'm hooked, and, you know, because this contact went on for years. Or was it prior to that, something that Don had told you that made you wanted to?
I missed the first part of the question. Could you repeat that, please?
I was going to say, in the beginning, do you know what the catalyst was, or could you share with us something that, what was that event, or did something, did Don tell you something that, what was the point that said, I'm going to dedicate, you know, years to this? And
what was, Don's dedication point, or mine?
No, I'm saying, what was your catalyst? What was the thing that said, I really want to be a part of this? Was there a particular event? You know, we all have these life-changing moments that come to us and says, you know, I really want to be a part of that, or
Well, it was that experience. It was after Don and Carla had invited me to join them, and I was really flattered, but I had been on this mailing list for Cosmic Awareness Communication for 5 years, and had always wanted to go out to Oregon, where they put it out, and where Paul Shockley lived, to help them out, because I had bought a lot of their material. And when Don and Carla invited me to join them, I was really flattered, but I went ahead and went out to Oregon. Like I said, after about 2 months, there came this opportunity to earn a lot of money. There was a fellow who was there from Canada. He was involved in mining diatomaceous earth, which at that time, and still has a lot of use, you know, for preservation of materials, people storing food long-term and so forth. And he needed somebody to be the general manager of that in the United States to help him sell it here in the United States. He offered me the job, which at that time he said would pay about $100,000 a year. Well, in any year, that's a lot of money. And so I took the weekend out to think about it, because I hadn't gone out there for money. I didn't have anything against money, but it seemed really odd to me that here was this opportunity to earn a lot of money. I just wanted to think about it. I wanted to meditate on it. And it was at that time that it took 30 whole seconds for this, like, comet to arc across my inner sky and tell me, you need to go back to Carl and Don in Louisville and join them in their work. And it was something I was just astounded to become aware of, because here I traveled 2,500 miles and I wanted to be here for 5 years. And all of a sudden, I got to go back to where I came from. And that sounded ironic. I'm not a person who likes to go back, but it just felt right. It felt like the thing to do. So, you know, like all along my life, it felt like the next step just sort of naturally presented itself to me. And if I was just open to it and naturally took it, all would be well. So I said, okay, here we go, back. And so it was, you know, at that time that I really decided that, you know, Don and Carla was where I wanted to be, is that feeling that I had when I looked into his eyes and when I was with Carla, that was something that was valuable. It wasn't just, you know, a passing fancy. It wasn't something to be ignored. It was something to be investigated and to be joined up with and see what happened.
Now, during all the subsequent years of this material, I mean, there's a lot of people. There's just hundreds of thousands, literally, so many people that I know. I literally, this is funny, I'm in a hotel right now, and last week, an individual was sitting across from me, we were talking, and she was kind of breathing heavy, and I said, are you okay? And she said, well, I'm fine today. And we started talking about material and stuff, and I said, well, I kind of like to meditate in the morning. She said, well, I forgot my stones. And she said, I forgot my stones. Well, it kind of opened up. I was like, okay, well, you know, I've got a handful of crystals here in my pocket. And so we just started to converse. And then she said that, you know, she had read The Reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. And I said, well, that, phenomenal. And then she says to me, she says, you know Ra, yes? And I said, you know, I'm thinking, you know, Ra, Ra'an, Ata. I just said, Ra, you know, Y-E-S. Is that what you're saying? And she said, yes. So she starts talking about the Law of One as well. So there's literally hundreds of thousands of people that are out there. But from being, you know, they always say we get a higher energetic vibration from being in higher energetic, meeting other beings such as that. And you've had to meet a catalyst of people over the years. Have you had any what you would call mystical experiences? Maybe if you could share those with us from all these various people that you've met over time.
Well, mystical experiences are kind of hard to describe. Carla is the one who's really been the mystic Christian. That's her real field. She has a better way of describing it. Experiences I have had, I would say, are more related to that therapy type of program that I went through before I met Donna Carla, when I first went to that Laughing Coyote Mountain Adventure Trail Survival School outside of Black Hawk, Colorado. He taught a type of therapy that, if you were successful, they frequently reported what was later called a frontal lobes experience, where the frontal lobes begin to open up, and you begin to feel the sense of unity with the creation. And it's especially felt in sexual energy exchanges and in the moment of orgasm. The orgasm becomes centered in that area between the eyes, in the brain. And the frontal lobe just opens up, and you get this feeling of incredible pleasure and pressure and unity and just energy flowing through incredibly. Now, I've never really understood a lot of what happened during those experiences. I've had a number of those. We did, at one point, ask Ra something about that. Ra suggested that this was the beginning of the opening of the indigo ray, that center between the eyes, and that as that ray began to be more balanced with the rest of the rays of the body, that one could eventually fully experience the presence of one infinite creator could be had. And they said I had much to which to look forward. And I think that is still in what we would call the future. But what I've experienced so far has been a beginning balancing, I believe, of the energy centers so that more energy can come through freely without being blocked by my various distortions. And it was those distortions are a handful of pre-incarnative choices that each of us has, that as we are able to remove more and more of them, it is the natural function of the brain to channel through this energy that is given to us freely, what Ra called the intelligent energy that would come from our sun body or the logos. It comes in through the soles of the feet, goes up through the energy centers, and then as it is able, is expressed at each energy center. And as we are able to balance those centers and work on those, the lessons that we program for ourselves are actually triggers that help us to move more energy through. And as we're able to balance ourselves and clear ourselves, then we're able to have unique experiences, each somewhat different than anybody else's. And it's sort of a riddle or a puzzle to come up with the ultimate answers. But eventually, I believe that it all reduces to the fact that all is one. And we each have a variety of ways of having that come through in whatever experiences we've had in meditation, in dreams, in sleep, and those aha moments that come to you during the day and you didn't even know you were thinking about that. So that's the best answer I could give, I think.
Now, which brings me to a question. Do you channel?
I have channeled I've channeled for 25 years. And then about 5 years ago, I decided to give it a rest unless I was needed in a channeling circle, because after 25 years of clawing and scraping and working at it the best I could, I became a mediocre channel. And I decided that the planet's got enough mediocre channels, and why do we need another one when I could be helping out Carla and using my energies more efficiently? So, yeah, I channel, but...
Now, Jim, was it something that came to you, or was it something you chose to do an experience to figure out how to do it?
Well, Carla can take you so far in the way she teaches it, but eventually it has to do with your personality and how willing and able you are to hang your ass over the line and to be willing to make a fool of yourself. because you have to be able to let go. Carla gives the analogy. Learning to channel is like throwing a number of balls, and you can't catch another ball until you throw the one you've got. You can't get another concept from the contact until you throw the one or speak the one you've got. And sometimes people aren't constructed in such a way, or they don't allow themselves to hang out over the line or be willing to be a fool. So I'm sort of that nature. Well, I could hang myself out over the line to a certain point, but it never seemed like I got any better, and it just seemed like I was I hadn't done as well as I wanted to do. So I figured we've got Carla here. Let's let her do a really good job, and let's invest our energies in other ways.
Yeah.
I had heard that you and Carla used to channel the same source, and that I had heard that you used to be able to pick up where she left off. Is it easier to channel when someone else is there and has established a source?
Channel when there are other people there, for sure. We never channel unless we have three, because there's a certain kind of energetic support that comes from that third person. So we always have another person there. But yeah, when there are more channels, it does help. And whenever we have channeling circles, it's common for the channel to move from channel to channel. And if it's people that are learning to channel, it could be as many as four or five people. We usually don't take more than that because it's more difficult to work with a larger number of people. But each of them then is able to pick up where the other leaves off. And you're not at the time so certain that that's going to turn out that way, because you're hanging your ass out over the line. But once you go back and you look at the material, you can see how, you know, it's a seamless flow of information. But at the time, if you're really concentrating, you're aware of usually only one or two concepts at a time. You don't try to remember what you've channeled. You know, you've got to be there in the moment. Later on, you can use your sense of analysis, or, you know, you can be skeptical later on. At the time, you need to be really gullible, and you need to get the words out. So, yeah, frequently the same entity channels through a number of channels, and Carl and I have done that a number of times, but it's a fairly common thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've never channeled per se, but my moment that made me really look into a lot of this information, it's the same question I kind of have for you, is, was it in the sense that I was raised up under the umbrella of Christianity, under Catholicism, and it was not until my grandfather died that he spoke to me. Just it felt like the back of my head opened up, kind of like a magnetic pole, and then I heard his voice. And that being the case, and he had already been dead for a couple hours, that was a major catalyst for me to go, you know what, he wouldn't have said that if it really wasn't important. But,
right.
You know, trying to bring, it took me years really to talk to anyone about it. But being a predominantly Christian nation that we are, and then, you know, my thing was, is I looked at channeling at first, and I'm like, you know, seems a little fringe. And then I started looking at all these other books that were out there, whether it be the, you know, the stuff, the material from George Green, or whether it be the material from Donna Elkins and yourself, and whether it be the material in Conversations with God. I started looking at this, as, you know, there's a tremendous amount of information which would go under the guise of channeling. And then there were so many scientific references to it when I poured into it. But a question for you, though. Do you refer to it as the raw material? Do you refer to it collectively as the law of one? Or how do you speak of this? Is it difficult for you to bring this up? And what are reactions from people that, you know, are predominantly Christian? Do they just see this as evil? Or, I mean, there's got to be some strong reactions.
Oh, yeah, all kinds of reactions. We originally referred to it only as the Law of One. It was the Schiffer Publications, the Donning Company at the time, actually, subsidiary of Schiffer, that was trying to ride on the coattails of the Seth material from Jane Roberts. And so they renamed it themselves, the raw material. And over the years, we've been, you know, we call it either one, but originally we looked at it only as the Law of One. But so many people call it the raw material that, you know, we use either term interchangeably nowadays. But we've had all kinds of responses. Carla's brother sort of excommunicated her for 23 years because he's a basic fundamentalist Christian, but then he had his own awakening, and they eventually come together. Occasionally, people will be skeptical and want some sort of an affirmation. And we're willing to answer questions. You know, if people want to look at it, they're free to look at it however they want to. I mean, it's, you know, free will is the most important thing here. If you're really attracted to the material, then it'll you know, it'll have its movement and its path through your life. And if it's not meant for you, that doesn't mean that you're a lesser person, or it's, you know, it just means that at that time it's not your step. And maybe at some future point it will be, or maybe it won't be. Maybe you'll get there some other way. It really doesn't matter. You know, we're all, you know, walking our paths the best we can. And we have these opportunities that come our ways. And when there's a sense of a magnetism almost, like the iron filing to the magnet, you know, there's that inner intuition, that still small voice that gives you a real hint that, well, you ought to look into that because there's something there. Then you follow up. And like you and the lady with the crystals, she's looking for her stone. You know, there's just these seemingly magical ways where people come together. And I think a whole lot of that is due to our openness, our willingness to be out there and then to share unconditional love and then to see people as yourself, to see them as the creator. So all kinds of wonderful things happen when you start on this journey. I think it's like a spiritual momentum is gathered, and you begin interpreting things in a more positive light, in a more incarnatively congruent light, you might say. Things just start happening, and it's a blessing.
When the you just mentioned earlier, and I think a lot of people just realize or think of the material that you have at LNL Research is strictly, you know, the law of one. And you were mentioning that you have tools and you have materials. What are the best tools that you feel that you have and you guys can provide at LNL Research? And maybe kind of outline if these are steps and what are the things that you want to start?
Cumulatively, there's all kinds of things. I mean, Carla comes from, she's a cradle Episcopalian, but she had mystical experiences her whole life long, so that she never took things literally. She was always getting a deeper meaning to things. My own path, like I said, I was fairly well just an all-American boy until 21, and then I started thinking about the meaning of life, who was I, where was I going, so forth. And Jane Roberts, curiously enough, and the Seth material was very instrumental for me. And coincidentally, I started reading her probably 10 years before I met Don Carlo, but she was the one who suggested to us that we send our material to the Donning Company, or ship of publication, it turned out to be.
So, I was curious about that. Yeah, that's a lot of material as well.
Oh, yeah. I was very interested in that. So I think that prepared me mentally and gave me a feeling of authenticity, just you know, the way Seth would respond to queries. Wouldn't be what you would expect. And that, I think that's the unexpected. Hynek always said the stranger a report of a UFO, the more likely it was true. So you know, that factor of the wildest, the strangest is an interesting factor. Paul Solomon and his work, his channelings, Paul Shockley, of course, the cosmic awareness communication and the channeling of the Akashic Records. Those have been very helpful to me. Don was raised a Christian Scientist, so they were always of the opinion that any illness that came your way was mentally created and could be mentally healed. They didn't go to Orthodox physicians. So he had that framework from childhood. And he had met most of the people who had done work back in the 50s. Being a pilot at an early age, he was able to fly to any part of the country and talk to whomever had had the whether it was Charlie Hickson in Pascagoula, Louisiana, or George Adams out in the deserts of California, or George Van Tassel, or George Hunt Williamson, or any, you know, Andrew Paharich, he'd gotten to talk to all these guys and was in on what was going on there. You know, he was he had so much to draw from that he had a way of putting it together himself. And the raw contact was really his big opportunity to finish putting the puzzle pieces together. I mean, he'd been doing this a long time. So the first book is really Don getting these errant puzzle pieces together and trying to figure out how things were going, you know, how things worked. And then in book two, he really got down to a more organized type of questioning.
The material from when you look at David Wilcock, and so much it has been cited that, you know, that there are many scientific breakthroughs in the material, but it took, you know, 10, 15, 20 years to discover, really, or to translate, in essence, to a physics level, what was translated, you know, back in the early 80s. There. Did you guys ever have any, or were there any concerns with any kind of Men in Black? Because the contact that you had seemed to be pretty significant, and the material, what was coming out, or was it held pretty close to you guys' chest? And when did you guys decide that this information needed to get shared? When did the experiment open up to this is something that needs to be told?
Oh, right away. I mean, Don was so excited about this. The first person he contacted was Dr. Andre Buharich. He was the one that brought Uri Geller to the United States and wrote the book Uri. And Don and Buharich had been talking back and forth for quite some time and been involved in some activities together. The Mind Link in 1977, a group of psychics got together and attempted to help heal the planet, and they were together on that. There was a lot of interaction with people from the beginning, especially other researchers. And I think it was probably session 14 or 15 where we finally had enough material together. We sent it to the Scott Meredith Literary Agency in New York City. And Mr. Meredith was kind enough to write us back a three-page, single-spaced, typewritten letter telling us why the law material, or the law of one, had no chance of being a success in the commercial market. He went into the grittiness of the German epistemology, and the question and answer format went out back with Socrates. And we were sharing it wherever we could, you know, to try to find a way of making it available to people. Don had, before he died, he had two things he asked of Carla. Number one, would she make whatever material we had available worldwide for free? And would she head up a spiritual community? And so that getting the material out had been foremost on our minds, especially Don's mind, from the very beginning.
Joel.
Yes.
And Jim, what I would like to do, if that's okay with you guys, that I check with the listeners to see if any of the listeners has a question.
Sure.
Now, those listening on BBS radio, there is a toll-free number you can call to BBS, and then we can hear you also. So I'll give you the phone number in just a moment. I will open the lines, and if you have a question, shout it out. The toll-free number, if you're listening to BBS radio, is 888-627-6008. Let me open up the lines. All right, the lines are open. Any questions from the listeners on the phone line? That means a no, so you're asking the right questions, Joel. That's a good thing.
I have a sort of a question.
Don, yes, yeah. Go ahead.
Can you do like a real quick overview of what you and Don Elkins think of the UFO phenomenon? Don't go into too much detail. We've all heard a lot about it, but what's your take on it?
Well, it was Don's feeling, and this is basically corroborated in his questioning of Ra, that the entire UFO phenomenon is a means of introducing the concept of mystery and the possibility of infinity to the mass mind of planet Earth. But that, they felt, was the best thing they could offer to help those on Earth on their spiritual journeys, wherever they were. So this mystery would cause people to begin asking questions. And maybe the questions would be formed around a specific contact that they were familiar with and the features of that contact. Those would vary from person to person, but the overall effect was generally shared by everybody that has, you know, whether it's a close relationship or a distant relationship from the UFO phenomenon, it has the ability to cause you to ask a question. Now, depending on how long you stay with those questions, you know, what is life, who am I, where am I going, where are these people from, what is other life like, what does this mean to me, all these questions would come up. As you begin to concentrate on them, however much energy and time you give to them, it's usually an indicator of how you're moving on your spiritual journey. Some people spend a lot of time on it. You know, they devote their lives to it, and it becomes a feature of their seeking that enables the seeking and it makes it more successful. And for others, it may just be an occasional question that will pop up. But it varies for people, but that was his basic feeling about the UFO phenomenon. If people could begin to entertain these two concepts, the concept of mystery, that there may not be solid answers to everything. You may have to think of things for yourself. You may have to get into yourself. The whole journey may be your responsibility. And infinity, the no end to things, what does that mean? When I was a little kid, the question that always came to me was, well, okay, well, after I've gone infinitely in a certain direction, then what? So all these questions at whatever level you are can spur your spiritual journey and help you get closer to the truth that it turns out within you.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Don, from Ohio, for your question. And I'll check one more time with the listeners. Are there any further questions?
Ready.
One minute.
Was it a yes? All right. Well, thank you so much. So back to you, Joel, the mic.
Okay. One of the things that I was curious is you had mentioned, you know, prior to making the big decision to move in with Don and Carla and to work with the group that you meditated. How old were you and when did you start to meditate and what was your catalyst to that?
Probably about 21. Like I said, I got interested in world religions at that time when I was a senior in college. And I did a little meditating then. I lived at the Newman Center. I wasn't a Catholic, but that was where Father John Scott lived, and he was a radical on campus, and so that's where the radicals were. And I was starting to think about these other things. And I did some meditating then, and after I moved, I joined the teacher corps after college and went to Florida, and began meditating more there and having time to investigate Jane Roberts and some other sources of channeling that turned out to be quite helpful to me. And then when I had my land in 74, I bought my own land in Central Kentucky and lived there before I met Don and Carla 7 years later. I meditated there a good deal. I took the mornings out using that therapy technique I'd learned in Colorado. I took the mornings for writing, for long essays, for reading, for thinking, for meditating, doing the spiritual things. And then the afternoons and evenings I spent in physical labor. But it was at that time, I guess, I really got interested in meditating and had a practice then that was probably the best, actually, I've ever had. Carl and I now do short meditations at the beginning and end of the day, 5 to 10 minutes, and occasionally longer. But meditation seems like it's always a tool that's there and it's available to be used as much or as little. It always has this value to it for me, what I've discovered over the years.
And Jim,
do you look at? I mean, do you do a breathing meditation? Is it sitting, forgetting? Is there one certain thing that you're focused on?
The technique I learned was from another meditator out at that school in Colorado. And that was sitting with the eyes closed and the focus between the brows to look for the brightest point of light in whatever field of vision you have there. And then focus on that light and let it become as large as possible. That usually made it somewhat brighter, but the light would become a little more dim. And again, within that new field of inner vision, look for the brightest point of light and continue doing that. And the goal, I believe, is to become the light, actually. But for me, I'm still working on being surrounded by the light. So that's my technique. Now, there are all kinds of other techniques, you know, whatever works for any person is, you know, the way to go. It's been our experience over the years. People have had all different kinds of techniques for meditating. They all seem to work. If you're really focused on the technique and give it your energy and give it your time, it works.
Well, I was and focusing on different times. I mean, I was born in the 60s, so I know you were living during interesting times. Now, was there any other groups that you were interested at the time? I mean, did you look at Ram Dass or Timothy Leary, or did you go to the desert to do peyote with the Indians, or was there any other?
Well, I was a very happy member of the hippie subculture. You know, drugs, sex, rock and roll was the 60s experience for me. And that led to Timothy Leary and led to Ram Dass and various other thinkers. The first book I read that really had the book, I mean, Taboo on Knowing Who You Are.
Do you know who that?
The book on the taboo against knowing who you are, and all of a sudden I'm blanking on the author of that. Anyway, that was the book. There were probably because it was in the 60s. I'm not remembering the author. Dylan said he was looking for somebody to help him remember the 60s because it was a blank for him. Yeah, there was a lot going on then, and that was just the time.
Somebody told me I had time.
Yeah. That was a time of just so much thought and so much individual expression. It was a wonderful time to be alive. And it at the end of that time period, I found myself in the teacher corps. And I was trying to look. I was looking for a way of being of service to others. And then I went from teacher corps to this book, The Raspberry Exercises, How to Build Your Own School and Start Your Own School and Build Your Own House. So in the back of that was this fellow in Colorado with Brain Self-Control. And that led me to Kentucky, and that led me to Don and Carla. So there's just so many things that came from that time, and I'm sure that each person has something going on in the life pattern that serves that purpose, because we all seem to have these. You talk to anybody else on the spiritual journey, and they've had all of these coincidences, magical happenings. They can tell you about what's happened, and it's so inspiring to hear different people's stories, because there's so many ways of traveling this path. Coming together, realizing that love is really the answer to all our questions, and it's because we're one being. And what else do we do with one being? We would love that being, you know, as ourselves, because it is ourselves. So yeah, there was so much going on in the 60s, and as a result, the 70s with the Back to the Land movement, meeting Don and Carla.
As it's you know, we live in more than interesting times now, and it can be pretty stressful, and it can be pretty crazy. What is it now? What are the things that bring you peace right now?
Well, being with Carla is the most important thing, and it's in a situation which you wouldn't think you'd find it. She has been down for 2.5 years with this back surgery wound that is very, very slow to heal, and it has given us a chance to find this love between us. And I'm a literal person. We repeatedly, everyone having their own bedroom when we moved to this house, but Carla's surgery necessitated her moving into my house, into my life, my heart, into my being. And it's been extremely literal. And for me, that's really, you know, the beginning of things, is this literal translation of things. And I've watched her move in, and we've had this love come, you know, spring up even more strongly between us that brought us together, and we just love each moment. And another person would look at this moment and say, you're kidding. You know, she's been in that bed for 2.5 years. You know, how can you possibly be having a good time? But I got to tell you, it's really possible. It doesn't matter where you are, it's who you're with. You know, that old, what would you do if? Well, you know, would you rather be in heaven with a fool or in hell with a saint? And, you know, basically, that's it. And we've just discovered this companionship, this team feeling between us of how we really complete each other. And that's been because we've been so close together, literally so close together over these last 2.5 years.
All right. It's 6:57, so we have to stop the show, and this was so wonderful. Thank you so much, Jim, for being here with us, and I thank you for asking those wonderful questions.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Bye. All right. Love to you and to Carla, and, you know, I thank everybody for being here on the phone and on BBS Radio. Thanks to BBS Radio, and, hey, until next time.
And Jim, and to everyone else, may you have many more loving and synchronistic encounters with people out there. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate it, Jim.
Thank you. Our love to you all.
All right. I'm opening up the lines. Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to Jim and everybody. Thank you.
Wow.
Good night. Yes.
Thanks.
Wow.
Wow.
It
was
great.
Yeah, wow.
It was nice. It was great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow.